This podcast was recorded before the government's advice on isolation and social distancing came into place. Stay safe, everyone, and enjoy the show.
It's the only time I've ever sent an email about a budgie, and I sent it straight to a client.
So what?
Can you expand on... That is our hook. Yeah. That is the hook. So we're starting the podcast with a five-second hook, yeah. Then we're into the music.
Hi guys, my name's Ollie and welcome to the first ever episode of the Cyber Sounds podcast. Every week we're going to be exploring the world of cyber in a light-hearted fashion. We'll be looking at some of the interesting aspects of cyber and doing a bit of crystal ball gazing to discuss where things are going in the future. Every week I'm going to be joined by my co-host Tom Pelham.
Hello.
And Lizzie Bardsley.
Hello.
And we're going to also be joined by some awesome guests along the way. So this week we're recording from London and we welcome Ash Burden, who's a cyber claims manager at CFC. So hi everyone and welcome to Ash. How are you doing, Ash?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Hi Ollie, Tom, Lizzie. I think first question I've got before we get stuck in is, what's that music all about? It's quite catchy, but there must be a story behind it.
Yeah, I think it's got us all going. I think, there's a bit of a story behind it. And I think it comes down to the fact that when we look at the cyber world, the cyber industry that we work in, we kind of see it as the Wild West out there. I mean, it's a
without
crazy
the cowboy
place.
Boots.
Without the cowboy boots.
Although yeah. You are wearing cowboy boots.
Proof that you're not.
Yeah. But one of the things I was looking at recently is the cyber most wanted, which is an FBI list of the most wanted cyber criminals. And it's as long as my arm. And I guess some of the attacks that we've worked on might actually have been started or been run by some of these FBI most wanted.
I'd love to know the average age of the people on the FBI most wanted cyber criminals list. It's probably like 22.
Yeah.
Does this most wanted list have their actual names?
Yeah, yeah.
Are some of them
and
pseudonyms?
Pseudonyms. Yeah, right, both. Yeah. Both. Flight risk, the proper wanted posters. If you go on the FBI website, there's a cyber page and there's proper wanted posters.
Is it bad as a cyber lawyer to want to be on the FBI's most wanted list? Sounds cool.
I think from the SRA's perspective, it's probably not quite bad.
Okay, maybe not.
So first on the agenda this week is, what does it mean to work in cyber and how do you explain your role?
It is difficult though, isn't it, to explain it. And people ask me, I think, as soon as they ask me what I do, I say insurance. And then I'm like, nope, don't worry, I'm not home insurance, not motor insurance, I do cyber. And they're like, oh, what is this? They just automatically think of a computer and whatever. And it's actually quite difficult, but I think the way I answer that is that we just help people that have suffered from a cyber attack get back up and running again, whilst being mindful of the legal considerations. So, my day to day is just trying to help people along with my team, the legal advisors such as Kennedy's, the techie guys, any PR firms, etc. Just really helping the insured get back up and running again, whilst protecting their brand and reputation to the extent we can.
Yeah.
In many ways, it's a kind of plate-spinning exercise, isn't it? Because there's so many considerations, and people think, with us, you know, okay, you're lawyers, so you're here to do the law bit, the law work. But actually, there's only about 15% of what we do is
very
for law.
Specific, Tom. 15.
I worked out it's about 16.4%. But my point is, it's a very small amount. It's the pure legal analysis. The rest is the PR, the commercial,
it's the project management,
bringing
it all together.
Also, all of it's happening at the same time and all of it is equally urgent.
And at the same time, everybody's running around screaming.
Yeah.
Especially when you've got insureds that, for the most part, have never experienced an attack before or a cyber event. And they don't really know what to expect. So I think that's where it comes down to us guys to sit down and explain the process with them. And again, like you say, Ollie, project managing. I mean, that's pretty much what we do on a day-to-day basis for the majority of our working day, really. Just sort of marshalling certain vendors, certain partners of ours, and just ensuring everyone's pulling in the same direction to ensure that, again, the insurer's back up and running again and meets any legal or contractual obligations they may have.
And often it's about showing that you genuinely care as well, because these are people going through really difficult times, and often they're concerned about their business going under, because some of them operate on a really sort of tight threshold.
Yep.
And it's about showing that you genuinely care, that you want to speak to them, you're happy to speak to them over the weekend.
That's exactly it. And I think you in this industry, dealing with the types of insureds and claims that we are, you have to show empathy, for sure. And just give them the level of comfort that you're there to assist them, and show them that you've got the experience and you've got the right contacts and you bring the right people in as and when you think you need to. We've had instances at CFC where insurers have been on their knees and they've been on the edge of bankruptcy and going into receivership, etc. But I take quite a lot of credit and I feel good when we avoid situations like that, where we can get an insurer back to where they were, and they're extremely grateful.
And that's what the policy is all about.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, get the insurer back to where they were prior to the loss.
Mm.
Whether that be restoring them in terms of putting their systems back to where they were, providing advice in terms of how they can secure their networks going forward. There's a grey area there in terms of betterment, but we're certainly there to help and provide recommendations where possible. Put them back to where they were.
Just think how breaches of biometric related data will be different to the breaches that we're dealing with now. So what happens if your facial recognition data gets stolen? What happens if your fingerprint data gets stolen? And it is already happening, because there has already been a breach
of
biometric data. So if I steal your passwords...
You can change them, right?
You can change them.
Yep.
It's fine. Minimal harm. But if I steal your facial recognition data, that's it. You're stuck with it, unless you go for plastic surgery.
I don't know how that's going to play out. I know that there's certain states in Chicago that are already putting legislation in place for breaches such as that, where statutory damages can be applied for, and which I don't think it really achieves anything apart from lines the pockets of plaintiff's lawyers out there. But there's got to be something that needs to be done here. And I think those industries and those companies that are storing that type of data, they need to be subject to much more scrutiny than they already are, to avoid, again, you're not going to avoid situations like this perhaps, but they need to have a certain level of security in place, for sure.
I guess the problem is with AI and machine learning, there's going to be attacks that are driven and improve as a result of AI and machines sort of bettering themselves. And so how do you guard against that? I genuinely don't know the answer to that. And I guess there'll be security mechanisms on the other side that will be perhaps machine learning and AI driven, but which one will win? And who's going to have the more sophisticated technology to keep the bad guys out?
But then I think in terms of the insureds that we see, a lot of it isn't particularly high-tech attacks. They often go for the low-hanging fruit. So even if they manage to... I think the kind of protection they have at the moment often isn't quite enough. It doesn't necessarily have to be very extensive. It just has to mean that you're quicker than everyone else and they can't catch up to you.
Mm.
I think that's fair. I think what we've seen, especially again in the small medium arena, is that the attacks aren't that sophisticated. They're a phishing link. You click on it. But then it's what the systems that are set up to do enable, it's how they enable the malware to propagate the network, right? So it's not even taking that many steps, and that, but for example, putting backups offline, that's not that much of a sophisticated step, but just put your backup in the cloud. If you're subject to ransomware, you've got a backup ready to deploy. It's just taking certain certain acts which perhaps wouldn't even cost that much money. It's just it's the awareness point, I think. I think that's probably a good segue into perhaps these major cart breaches that, from our perspective, it's obviously we're seeing a lot more, and I know that we've dealt with you guys at Kennedy's a lot on them, and I don't know, maybe Ollie, you want to give an overview of sort of what they look like?
Yeah, I mean, major cart is a conglomerate of different hacking groups, and it's the group that is targeting websites for payment card skimming, payment card harvesting. So BA is probably the most famous attack, which was major cart driven. But I mean, we've seen them attack, you know, any size, any level of company, organization. If they are taking payment card details over the internet, then major cart can inject a code through the payment card payment page of the website and skim off the details. But I guess you're seeing them all the time.
Yeah, there's definitely an uptick in those type of instances, and they bring their own challenges because you've obviously got the payment card industry considerations where you have to carry out a PFI investigation. Then also you're probably going to want to bring in your own investigation as well to look at the position from perhaps a more holistic point of view to figure out what's happened and remediate.
And there's sometimes a pressure there from the insured just to stick with a PFI investigator, but it's a totally different they've got a totally different focus.
It really is. So yeah, the PFI's scope is much more narrowed. They literally have a checklist of information and things they need to look at, whereas your own investigator would come in and, as I say, look at it from a more sort of high level and really dig into how it happened. So the attack vector, figure out how they can sort of avoid that from happening again, and maybe give it from more of an independent point of view, because obviously the PFI is acting on behalf of the banks. They're engaged to look at certain aspects of the incident, whereas your own investigator is looking at it from a more high level point of view.
But crucially, from our perspective, our own investigator, that's privileged. So as long as we instruct them, then nobody ever has to see that report, which is not the same as the PFI investigator.
And depending on the outcome of that investigation, that can prove rather helpful in some situations. But we're seeing a lot more, and they bring their own challenges. And I think you guys handled one where there was a multi-jurisdictional breach and pulled in your different offices, as Elizabeth was saying, and I think it just worked extremely well. So it's having that set up and those connections in place beforehand.
Well, I've got some stats here on Major Cart as well. So did you know that it's been active for over 9 years as a group? I didn't know that.
No.
And apparently 18,000 websites have been breached by Major Cart.
18,000?
18,000.
Can only imagine how many credit cards and individuals' data has been compromised as a result of those.
Yeah, I mean, just think of the cost to the credit card companies.
Well, you've got that sometimes gets sent back to the client that's been compromised. You've got the rep harm.
Yeah.
You've got the loss of sales. There's a whole sort of raft of consequences of one of these breaches, right?
But is that the tip of the iceberg?
Maybe.
I mean,
they're reported, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, is that 18,000 reported? But
yeah, I mean, there are 600 known C2 domains, which is the typo squat domain that hosts the malicious code. 600 of those domains that are constantly regenerating with that malicious JavaScript code and hosting it. So, I mean, as an operation, this thing is just absolutely huge.
And it's hitting some major brands as well.
Yeah.
You know, these are not just small-scale SME e-commerce businesses. These are major, major brands.
Well, it's always the way with these things that what starts out as a seemingly small issue always unravels to be a lot bigger. And I I can't count the number of occasions where we've had that initial call with the client and they say, yeah, we found this code, but we think it's probably only been on the website for a few days. It's fine. And then we get forensics on board and we realise it's been on the website for about 6 months, and then it's a whole different challenge.
We had one which wasn't a major card breach. It wasn't even a business email compromise. It was some quirky issue that the insured had suffered. And on the initial call, they said that 40 data subjects had been impacted. And within 2 days, once we got IT forensics in, it turned out it wasn't 40, it was 38,000. Yeah, and that makes quite a big difference to how you then deal with a breach. And actually, it's not just 40 UK-based, it's 38,000 across the world. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you've got a totally different prospect on your hands.
We see that fairly often as well, where an insurer thinks they've done a certain level of investigation. We ask a couple of questions and then, oh no, actually, maybe we didn't look at this to the extent we should have. So I think it's all about getting the right people in sooner rather than later.
But it can be quite hard with the timings. I mean, the ICO notification has got to be done within 72 hours of your awareness, and often your awareness doesn't coincide with your awareness of the fact that there is an issue doesn't coincide with the awareness of the scope of that issue. And so on that particular one where we're told it's 40 individuals, we notify on the basis it's 40 individuals, and then we have to go back and say, actually, sorry, it's not 40, it's 38,000. And that makes instantly your credibility's gone. And that's quite a challenge, dealing with those first couple of days.
I think that's where the ICO deadline, if I'm being honest, probably hasn't helped to that extent, that people are rushing to get those notifications in and perhaps they're not in the most informed position to be making those notifications. But I think it comes down to the way those notifications are made. And if it was in that instance that you explained to your ICO, we're aware of a breach, we think it's only 40, but we're still continuing our investigations and we'll update you in due course, then I guess that probably would have went down a little bit better than, oh, no, it's 40. Mm. And then 2 weeks later, wherever it is, oh, no, actually, it's 38,000. Mm. But, yeah, I don't necessarily think the urgency attached with the notifications to the ICO are helping that to a degree.
But I mean, the difficulty we are often facing at the moment is that at that very early stage, you have an idea as to what might have happened, but the language that you need to use, because you haven't definitively been able to say that there's been a breach, is based around there may have been a breach and there may be this amount of people that's been affected. And when we have been notifying the ICO on that basis, they've been coming back to us very quickly and saying you've not got enough information to be able to hit that threshold, which is quite interesting because it's a complete change in the way that they've been approaching these incidents. And initially they were accepting those emails or forms as notifications, but they've been kicking them back now. And again, it's an interesting question: does that notification remain valid, or does that mean that notification is wiped out? And so you have to notify when you then become reasonably aware or reasonably certain that there's been a breach further down the line. And when is that? When does the threshold jump to that level of certainty?
But there's a sting in the tail, isn't there, with the ICO coming back saying we're not accepting this as a notification because you're too vague as to whether a breach has occurred. Because they then go on to say that the mere fact that you're not sure as to whether a breach has occurred might be a breach in itself. Because you should have the systems in place to be able to identify when a breach happens.
I wonder how much of their attitude towards it, the change in it, is due to the fact that they're completely snowed under as well. I think that must have a huge amount to do with it. The fact that initially they were accepting these notifications and now they're just trying to push them off definitely feels like trying to get things off their desk, because people are over notifying, which is unsurprising when the whole system is geared up to being precautionary, basically.
I think it's that and the education piece. I think the ICO are learning as well that we want to be made aware of instances which are in themselves actual data breaches that should be cause for concern. But I think they've quickly realised that 72-hour deadline has resulted in extremely cautious notifications, such as losing a laptop, or the laptop doesn't have any sensitive information, but just in case, for whatever reason you did have, I'm notifying you just in case. And I think it's...
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because there's some of those ones, instances that I'm talking about, is circumstances where an insured has been notified by their inquiring bank that they've recognised the insured as a common point of purchase for fraudulent transactions. And in my head, that is a big red flag that there's been an issue, combined with the fact that they've perhaps identified a code on the website. Those two things together, in my view, are enough to stop the clock, but they're kicking it back. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is to it, but I mean, we've never been challenged on it yet, because we'll always go back to that initial email from the ICO saying they don't think that we've given enough information, and say, actually, we think that we have, just to cover our back. So I guess we'd have to wait to see how it pans out. Well, I think that probably brings us on nicely to the next section of this podcast, which I like to call Ransomware or Racehorse. You like that? I've been practicing Brilliant. That one.
I like that. Can you maybe just do that again? I enjoyed it so much.
What, from the start?
It's yes. just your whole face changes.
Yeah. If only you guys could see this.
I would, just because this is probably going to go viral, so I'm going to video this as well.
Okay. So, right. It's not that funny.
It is the face.
Okay, so that brings us on to the next section of this podcast, which is called Ransomware or Racehorse. So
yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah,
that's good.
That's good.
Yeah, that's good. I like it.
Do you see where we're going with it?
Not just yet, no. I'm okay, quite intrigued.
So basically, I don't know how this came to me. It was one of those things that I woke up in the middle of the night and about two nights ago and thought that this would be a good idea. I just thought that the names of ransomware are always quite wacky.
Ah, now I see where this is
and
going.
And I thought, they're quite similar to the names of racehorses.
Okay.
So, we thought we'd ask you a few questions. We'll give you a few names, and you have to decide whether you think it's the name of a racehorse. This is the official name of names of racehorse, which are logged with the official racehorse website. What's it called, Elizabeth?
British horse racing website.
.co.uk.
100%.
Yeah, it's totally legit. And types of ransomware.
Okay.
So it's either a horse or it's ransomware. So, are you ready?
Yep.
Okay, first one. Hidden key. Hidden key. Is it ransomware or racehorse?
Racehorse.
That is correct. Well done, Ash. Well done. Well done. That's one. How many should we do? Three?
Three.
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 And how many has got to get right?
Oh.
Because it is a...
Three. It's he's an expert.
It's a pretty decent prize as well.
It is pretty decent. Okay, number two. Popcorn time. Popcorn time. Is that ransomware or is it racehorse?
It's a difficult one. I'm going to go for racehorse.
That is incorrect. That's ransomware.
Popcorn time.
Popcorn time.
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Lizzie, can you expand
on that?
I've
seen that one before.
Yeah, it sounds like a really weird one. Apparently it's one where if it infects your device, then the way that you can decrypt your files is by sending it to two more people who will pay your ransom for you.
Okay.
It's quite an interesting one because it's sort of getting the victim to continue to perpetrate the crime.
Okay. It's like a malicious version of those emails that used to go around when we were young, that if you don't send this to seven people in your address book, a really bad thing would happen. They would have a list of ridiculous stories of things that happened to people who hadn't sent the email around.
You have to send it.
Yeah, it's like John from Iowa lost his wedding ring on the day he decided not to send the email around. But then how did they know? Because presumably they created the email before John from Iowa decided not to send the email around. Unless people just add to it. I don't know. Is there an option to add to it? Maybe. Anyway, I didn't send the email around.
What happened?
Well, look at me.
Enough said.
Ash, are you ready for number three?
For sure. Yeah, here we go.
Crypto pirate. Is it horse or is it ransomware?
It is proving more difficult than I thought. I'm going to go with ransomware.
It's actually a horse.
Serious? Yeah. I wasn't sure if it was trying to sort of bluff me in terms of...
There's so many bluffs.
We're
going
to have to
do
this at five, aren't we?
Yeah.
I think Ash has another opportunity to win.
Yeah.
The amazing prize.
They're difficult. Did you guys get them right? Well, I suppose you knew them anyway, but...
We invented them.
Yeah, but...
we own the horses.
These are all Kennedy's own. Can we do one more?
We can do one more?
Yeah, I want to try and get my dignity back.
Yeah.
Just one more.
One more to get your dignity
back. If I can draw this, then I'm good.
Okay. So... Croton. K-R-O-T-T-E-N. Croton. Is it horse or is it ransomware?
Racehorse. I'm sticking to my guns here.
I thought you were an expert, Ash.
Certainly not.
It's ransomware. How do you not know that?
I've never come across these.
No, we had to look quite deep to find these.
So you're not saying you've seen cases involving those?
No.
You've just researched the most obscure ransomware.
The depths of the internet.
Okay. Purposefully tried to
catch
bluff
me out.
You.
And you've done it. Well done. I got one right.
You got one right. I think that's respectable.
Yeah, I wouldn't say so, but... Should we move on?
Right. Okay, the budgie. Ash, have you heard about the budgie?
I haven't heard of the
budgie. Okay,
no.
So Elizabeth responded to an email from an insured, thinking it was just to Ollie and I. Yeah,
in my defence, I had just got my work mobile, and I didn't know how to use it yet.
Yeah.
Don't know if that's much of a defence.
I mean,
and I was on the bus,
confusing.
So I was trying to...
I might try and find an email.
I was trying to work.
I think it needs to be read out.
It does. It is genuinely spectacular.
I'm intrigued.
It's the only email I've ever sent to a client without meaning to.
I found it.
You found it? That was quick. He's got it in his favourites.
Where is it? I found the response emails. Oh, here we go. Okay, so this was... From Lizzie to me and Tom, copied in the insured, the CEO. Hi, both. Hope the journey was okay. Read the notifications. I'll have the drafts with you later. I just have to head to my aunt's house first, because apparently she has caught a budgie that needs help. Don't ask. Thanks, Elizabeth. And then you forwarded that to us again immediately after, saying, oh, God, just seen that I've sent the email to the insured.
Yeah.
So what was wrong with the budgie?
So my aunt and my mum found a budgie in my aunt's garden that kept coming down. They were very worried about the budgie, but they needed help catching it because my aunt's got a fear of flapping things. which you actually knew the word for. What is the word for the fear? Yeah, flapophobia.
I had to look it up. I was showing off.
I'll go with flapophobia.
Yeah.
Flapophobia.
Cheeky Google search that you don't tell anyone about. We've all done it. Pretend it's original content, but it's not.
I did a lot of prep for this podcast, but one thing I did not do was check the name for fear of flapping objects.
How's your Donald Trump fake news impersonation?
Oh, okay.
I've never done a Donald Trump fake news.
Have you not?
No.
Have you not said sad?
I've done it in the privacy of my own home.
Maybe now's the time.
No.
We'll cut it out. It's fine.
No. I'm not.
Come on.
No, Donald Trump is not something I can do.
The problem is, I think you need the hands as well.
You do.
Yeah,
you do.
It doesn't work. Just the voice.
You do.
You can do a good Lloyd, though, can't you?
I'm not. I promise myself I would not. What? Get Lloyd out.
Lloyd
not Grossman.
Lloyd Grossman.
Oh, wow. I want to hear this. Come on.
What's the trigger word? Tom has a certain trigger word for each impression. If you get the trigger word correct, you won't get him out of it. And then you need another trigger word to get him out of it. But then that
like
sometimes leads into something different.
I then end up with just going on this sort of crazy merry-go-round of internal monologues of other people. And I then have to go to sleep to try and get out of it.
Is the keyword digested?
So cogitated, deliberated and digested, and the winner of MasterChef 1991 is Paul. Congratulations, Paul.
That's impressive. I like that.
The thing is, it's meaningless to
the
me.
The sad thing is,
do you not know who this is?
I've never listened to Lloyd Grossman.
He makes bolognese sauces. You'll see him on the front of the bolognese.
But I've never heard what he sounds like. You are my first.
That is brilliant. That is very good. That's
indication of what he sounds like.
And then sometimes, if I'm not careful, the whole weekend is then Lloyd.
You're Lloyd Grossman.
And then we go on to the through the keyhole.
Okay, yep.
Sort of stuff. Which that is too bad to bring out.
That's a whole podcast in itself.
Yeah, that is a whole podcast in itself.
Well, there we have it. The very first Cyber Sounds podcast from Kennedy's. We hope you enjoyed the first episode. Some thank yous to do now. First of all, a huge thank you to Ash Burden for being our first fantastic guest on the show. Secondly, a massive thank you to Kennedy's for making this happen, and also to Robin Richards, who wrote and recorded our brilliant music. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.